the UCR Podcast.
Bob Seger has long been one of the great storytellers in songwriting, a blue-collar voice who stayed true to his roots and remained in his home area of Detroit, Michigan, even after he became famous. Like many of you, the first time I heard Bob's music, it was on a jukebox. It was hearing the hit records on radio and MTV, and eventually, all of that led me to the albums. As I discovered, I had a lot to learn about Bob Seger, and that journey took me even further back, where I began to listen to the albums that Bob had made for a number of years before the fame came. It's a fascinating trip. Bob Seger turned 80 this week, and it was also this month in 1978 that he released his 10th album, Stranger in Town. I wanted to get together with Gary Graff, who's been in Detroit covering Bob and his career for decades. I'm glad we were able to carve out some time because it was really good to hear some of Gary's recollections. We talk about a number of subjects, including Bob's early albums, the things that remain unreleased in Seger's vault, and some of the things that were in the vault that we've heard in the past couple of decades. Gary details what makes the Silver Bullet Band special, in his opinion, and talks about the experience of working on the book Traveling Man, On the Road and Behind the Scenes with Bob Seger, a great book that bottles a good amount of Seger history, including stories from those early days and albums. It's Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you checking out the UCR Podcast. If you're a Seger fan, you've come to the right place, because we write a lot about Bob Seger at Ultimate Classic Rock. Here's my conversation with Gary Graff as we celebrate Bob Seger's 80th birthday. We're here to talk about Bob Seger at 80, and I already had you marked down for a return visit to talk about your 80s book, but as this week was in progress, I was like, man, we have to talk about Bob Seger at 80. So we are going to do that. But first, before we dig in, I did want to give folks a bit of a preview about your new book, because that's coming out May 20th. Can you talk about that a little bit as far as, you know, what folks can expect?
Yeah, it's 501 Essential Albums of the 80s, a lot like 501 Essential Albums of the 90s, except 501 different albums. Yes. You know, we go through the decade, we made the hard choices, and we had the fights and the arguments and the mud wrestling and everything that comes with putting these books together. And I think hopefully it'll be another book that causes arguments, but that ultimately everybody's going to say, okay, if you want to know about the 80s and music, here's this book. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think what I like about your books is that there's so much fighting and arguing and mud wrestling, which I think is somewhat unique. I don't know how many other people are incorporating that into the making of their books. So I think that makes the book unique as well.
It makes it very interesting, and keeps everybody on their toes. Never know when you're going to get whacked with a taser or something by one of your contributors. And I tend to walk among my contributors with these books. So you know, you do have to keep looking over your shoulder.
That's fantastic. Well, all right. So Bob Seger is 80 years young this week, and you've been covering Bob's career in Detroit for more than 40 years now, but you were a fan before that. So I wanted to start there. Kind of, how did Bob's music land on your radar initially, and what is it that kind of grabbed you about what he was doing?
Yes, I was growing up in Pittsburgh, and I had the same Bob Seger experience that a lot of people did. I heard Ramblin' Gamblin' Man when I was young, and I think my brother, it was through my brother I heard that. And then as a teenager, you know, all of a sudden Live Bullet pops up and you start hearing this guy, and then Night Moves happens, and oh, this is some big new, you know, rock star I need to be paying attention to. And then you learn the backstory and read everything. But he is the quintessential Midwestern rocker. And, you know, for somebody like me growing up in Pittsburgh, quintessential Midwestern rock and roll city, as much as we like to pretend we were East Coast, you heard it. You heard the heart. You heard bits and pieces of your life. A lot of cars, a lot of girls, or if you prefer, young women. A lot of misadventures with same. A lot of insecurities. A lot of music about finding yourself, and just really, really well written songs. You know, he had those choruses that really stuck with you. There was an interesting aside to this that I interned for the big concert promoter sophomore and junior year, and we had Seger and the Against the Wind tour, two big nights at the Pittsburgh Civic Arena. And one of my duties with the promoters was when they had a big arena sellout, they made a commemorative plaque to go with all the other crap these artists needed. But the first time I went to interview Bob Seger in 1982 at his management offices in the Detroit suburbs, I'm walking up the steps and there's the plaque I made sitting on the wall, of their office. So that was a fun connection.
Had you seen Seger before the Against the Wind tour? Like what was kind of your first experience, and like, what do you kind of remember about all that?
No, that was it. The Against the Wind tour was the first one, just because I just never had the opportunity for one reason or another. I wasn't in the same place, or I don't know, maybe Jethro Tull was playing the same night. And, you know, the 16-year-old me wanted to, you know, chose that. So, and I just remember being blown away by the Against the Wind tour, because that's still when he was putting on a show that had the energy that could rival a Bruce Springsteen. You know, I mean, he just came out, feel like a number, blazing, and didn't stop. Even the ballads had an intensity that really took the show to another level.
Yeah, you and I were talking about like some of the live stuff from over the years, and it's like, and I was re-listening to Nine Tonight, which I think that, you know, Nine Tonight and Live Bullet are kind of both interesting on their own merits. They both kind of present a different picture of Bob Seger and, of course, where he was at that time. But like, it's like you mentioned, trying to live my life without you, in the process of getting to talking about the B-side, which was Brave Strangers. Yeah. And so you mentioned, really just by default, two of my favorite songs from the Nine Tonight record, where it's just like, when you talk about how Seger was putting on a live show at the time that, as you say, could rival what somebody like Springsteen was doing, Tom Petty, the Heartbreakers, and so on. One of the things that he was doing in, you know, that song as an example, Trying to Live My Life Without You, is like, he would get into the kind of this conversation with the audience. And he does the same thing for folks that have not heard Brave Strangers. I think that Brave Strangers is kind of one of the songs that got away in Seger's catalog. It is just an underrated song. But as you were telling me in email, they put that on as a bonus track to the CD reissue of Nine Tonight when that came out, I don't know, a decade or so ago, whatever it was. And that's another one where it's just like, he gets midway through the song and he starts, you know, talking to the crowd about having a six pack of Strohs. And it's like, I would almost believe that maybe Bob Seger still drinks Strohs at that point. Like, he just had a way of projecting this authenticity to the audience that like made him a very likable guy that you were like, man, if I could spend like a Friday night hanging out with that guy, I would do that in a second. And so it's just like, I think that's something that like those live records, and in particular, perhaps Nine Tonight, like does a really good job of communicating that.
He had that. His gift, I always felt, was he could take the James Brown shtick and make it sound like a normal guy. So, you put it very well, a guy you could hang out with and having that conversation and tapping into his memory banks and relating to things. We all drank underage beer. Us guys were all afraid of women, when we were young. And he related so much of that. And even when he was when you listen to Heavy Music from Live Bullet, just the vamp in that, it was not soul singer shtick. It was a guy from his heart saying whatever you felt like was saying whatever came to mind. Of course, it was practiced to a degree, but he was saying whatever was on the top of his head, and very, very relatable.
It had to be a trip for you when you came from Pittsburgh to Detroit. I would imagine, I would think perhaps, that would kind of change the view that you had of Seger's music, being there kind of in his backyard and seeing how it played there on the home turf, because that's always kind of an interesting thing to see. And as you and I were getting ready to talk, the other thing that I think about is that, as you know, like people like Bob Seger, when they become successful, they are not necessarily always embraced in their home city. And so it's just like, I think that's another kind of special element, is just to see the way the people of Detroit and surrounding areas react to Bob Seger. So like, did that change kind of like your perception of what Seger was all about, kind of getting to see him in his home area like that?
Yeah, it went from being okay, Bob Seger, this guy I listened to on the radio and was a fan of, to like being in Vatican City. You know, this was, you know, Bob Seger has, still has, but you know, certainly had at that time, tremendous amount of goodwill in Detroit. Some of that came from playing, you know, if you had a dollar for every person who says Bob Seger played at their high school, or you know, their dance or whatever, you know, you would be the richest man in the world. But he just never gave up the roots. Still lived around here. Even when he was in Los Angeles, people felt like he still lived in and was part of Detroit, still sang about Detroit, sang and wrote about his Michigan upbringing. So he never abandoned the area, and therefore the area never abandoned him.
You helped former Seger tour manager Tom Weschler put together a great book that came out in 2009 called Traveling Man, On the Road and Behind the Scenes with Bob Seger. The book, as the title would suggest, documents the decade plus that he spent out there on the road and also just generally working with Seger's camp. And Tom's stories are pretty fascinating. What did the experience of working with Tom on that bring out for you in regard to Seger's story?
Sure. First of all, the book was my idea. Actually, and I was the one who put everything together for that conceptually, with the design, the way the book was going to be laid out and everything. And that was because Tom and I were talking about doing, he's a photographer in general, not just with Seger, but in talking about doing some sort of book project, you know, we just kept looking at his stuff. And what kept recurring was, wow, you have all these great Bob Seger photos, because he was the tour manager, road manager, aide de camp. And, you know, so he had this very intimate association with Bob. And you had pictures of Bob at home, Bob in the studio, on the road, things that nobody had ever seen. And that was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to see these photos of Bob, you know, without the beard and the long hair, with the page boy cuts and the Beatles haircuts, and playing at the opening of a shopping mall, and, you know, shirtless in a studio with his acoustic guitar, and just seeing all these moments that, you know, we're all used to a particular picture of Bob Seger from the Live Bullet, Night Moves era, you know, the big long brown hair and the beard and the mustache. And this was other stuff. And it was really cool. And then to hear Tom's stories in some ways weren't surprising. I mean, you knew Seger was a hard working road warrior. And that's really what you had, was the picture of a guy who, this kid who wanted to be a musician, wanted to be a rock and roll star, and how he got to do it and the hard work it took to do it.
Seger has this long period that's well documented in that book where the records were not landing with people. And Bob suggests in a quote that's part of the piece you wrote for the book, that perhaps the music was not good enough. He says, "I played too many nights and I really didn't have enough time to write." And for fans of Seger's music, we've long known that he holds everything to a really high standard. The music was kept under lock and key, I'd say in the same way that Springsteen and Petty did it, if he thought it wasn't good enough. But how accurate do you think his assessment is of the albums and material from those early years? Because there's kind of a divide between perceptually how it appears that Seger and Punch Andrews feel about those records based about how the fans feel about those records. And as we know, it's like fans tend to hold those records really dear and wish that they could have them on CD or, you know, stream them or whatever in their collection. And it's like, it's kind of, unless you're looking in the right dark corners, it's this lost period of Seger's career that a lot of folks can't get to.
And they really should be able to, you know, there's merit being out there. I think Bob was a little hard on himself, but not necessarily a lot hard on himself. When you get to Beautiful Loser, you can really hear he had learned a lot of lessons and he had taken a step back and applied a much more advanced and sophisticated attitude towards songwriting and recording to that record and then the albums that came after that. Before, it was a little more slapdash. The songs, if anything, maybe weren't as finished as they could have been and weren't as polished as they could have been. There were still a lot of good songs between Ramblin' Gamblin' Man and Beautiful Loser, but he didn't always take the time to finish them. You know, sometimes when we
even we as writers, you know, we slap something together, especially if we're on deadline, and, you know, we send it, it gets published, and then, you know, you wake up the next morning thinking, I should have done this or that. And I think that's what you have with a lot of songwriters, and certainly in Seeger's case. There was a lot of, okay, we got to make this record and finish it by now so we can get back and, you know, back on the road and keep to our touring schedule. And starting with Beautiful Loser, he took the time to finish and to polish and, you know, really make the records sound like records and then translate those songs into live performance.
Yeah, and when you talk about the further thought that occurs after you hand something in, I think that Live Bullet's a good example of that, you know, when you hear like how he ultimately marries like Traveling Man and Beautiful Loser together into like one kind of like long piece, it's like, that's just like, that's one of those moments that like the first time you hear that on the radio or the first time you saw Bob and the band do that live, it's just brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the credit for that midsection goes to Chris Campbell, the bass player, who helped to put that together. It's funny, I was just looking, I have a bootleg from Schaumburg, Illinois, 1976, when they were performing the two songs separately and at different times of the set. And then to listen to that and then go and then listen to what they did with it on Live Bullet, it's like, yeah, stroke of genius here. You know, this is how they sound like they were always meant to be done like this.
Based on what you know, and it's so interesting, this is something we should probably talk about, is just the way Bob's legacy is being handled overall. Like, it's really interesting because he's not taking the same path that his peers are at this point, be it obviously the Tom Petty estate and everything they're putting out, Springsteen and everything that he's been putting out in the past several decades. Like, so as a starting point, what do you think the chances are that we are ever going to see those early albums come out? Because it's like 2017, Bob Seger System, Ramblin' Gamblin' Man, they put that out on vinyl and, you know, it's on digital download as well. So that's available, but basically everything else remains put away.
I think 50-50, in terms of the odds. For some reason, they're holding back on it. And I'm not entirely sure if it's not the label that says, you know, these records didn't sell back in the day. What makes us think they're going to sell now? I think there are different feelings about maybe how they should be packaged. Like, I think the obvious package here is these come out as Bob Seger, The Lost Era, or whatever, in a box set type of package, or you make a compilation of the best of those albums. There doesn't seem to be any movement or any interest from within, which I find curious, and I, like a lot of fans, find frustrating. But I remember having discussions with them about a plain old box set back when, you know, that's when what people did was, you know, 3-4 discs, you know, best of with unreleased material. And the Seger camp had no interest in it. These are the same people that had no interest in MTV in 1983. You know, they truly do march to the beat of their own drummer when it comes to this kind of stuff. But I do think they are sometimes not tuned in to what the market wants and I believe would support. I mean, Bob Seger has his own version of what Springsteen's, you know, going to be doing in June of Tracks 2. He has enough unreleased material and really, really good unreleased material from the actual song Stranger in Town, Before and After. There's great stuff around that would make great archival release, but there really doesn't seem to be the appetite for doing it, nor does there seem to be a lot of interest in explaining why.
Are there albums that were put away like Springsteen did?
Not entire albums like that, but a lot of songs. I mean, there were albums for which Bob worked on 20, 30 songs. And, you know, 10 or 12 made it out, and some were considered for later albums. So there's material there. There is a great lost Seger kind of set, and they did that one release, the early Seger, where, you know, they had the four old songs and then the four newly recorded versions of old songs, and we thought that was going to be the start of something, and it's been crickets since.
Yeah, I mean, that window, like from that early Seeger release, The Rain Would Come, is just a stunning song, yeah. Just stunning. So, and as we've seen from Springsteen and Petty, like these folks, like I talked to George Strakoulias about a Petty release at one point, and he was just like talking about the conversations that he had with Tom and with Mike Campbell at the time that they were putting together the playback box set. And he just kept going one song after another. He kept going, guys, what was the problem with this one? What was the problem with this one? And all the excuses, like he said that his line back to them was like, you guys are crazy. These are all good songs. And so it's just like, we got the smallest sliver of that with the unreleased songs that were on the early Seeger thing, that Seeger has some of that stuff as well.
Yeah. These guys are, you know, and I grant them their perfectionism. You know, the high standard is why they're the great artists they are, but there comes a point, I think, in all of their careers, and I think Seeger certainly added in that he is retired, he's done. It's time to let some of this stuff out. It's time to make your fans happy. And it's time to give, I guess, the music scholars among us a broader look at what you were doing, or, you know, a bigger picture of your artistry. I think it would only benefit his legacy to do that. But like I say, no interest, no discussion. When it comes, it will come out as a surprise. Will it come out? Will Bob still alive? Who knows? Will it take his kids, you know, to want to go dig into it and say, you know, we want to do this for Dad and put this music out there? It's hard to tell what's holding him back from that. I mean, he's not interested in being a musician anymore, and that's fine. So give it to somebody else. You know, let the archival folks do what they do, dig into it, and present something for you to say yay or nay.
All right, last few things here, Gary. Sure. We'll wrap. First of all, Bob's 10th studio album, 1978, Stranger in Town, was released this week in 1978. Like, where does that kind of sit for you? Like, for fans that perhaps are unfamiliar with the record, what is kind of, you know, notable about this record in the Seeger catalog from your perspective?
You know, first of all, it was the big follow-up, you know, so, you know, he busted through in a big way with Night Moves. Could he do it again? Yes, he could do it again. And, you know, I like Night Moves a little better because Night Moves was a little more gut bucket. That evolution to more polished recording was a little more prevalent on Stranger in Town and would become more prevalent on Against the Wind. But still, really good song. I mean, I don't know that there's a bad song on Stranger in Town. You know, I tend to, when even in the old vinyl days, I tended to skip over We've Got Tonight. Again, you know, teenage rock kid. I want this slow down lovey-dovey crap, you know, give me feels like a number or Brave Strangers or something like that. Rock me. But We've Got Tonight is still a great song. And he was just, I think he went into that record with more, he let the confidence of Night Moves' success eclipse any of the follow-up pressures that somebody in that position might have felt, you know, and they were still touring. Silver Bullet Band was on the road, you know, a lot. And so I think, you know, he was sharp. He was honed from touring, had a bunch of good songs to do, and just kind of went in and did it like he did the one before.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because he does these records where he does like half of them with Silver Bullet Band. And then he also like records with the Muscle Shoals guys. And I don't think anybody that is an artist is ever in, you know, if they're in Bob's shoes or whoever, if they have the opportunity to record at Muscle Shoals with those guys, they're not going to pass it up. But I found myself, as I was listening to Stranger in Town, specifically, you know, a song like Old Time Rock and Roll, like it's like you and I have both seen Bob and Silver Bullet Band play that many times live. They have that swagger. Like, so, like, I guess I wonder, just like fantasy, rock and roll, armchair quarterback, is it a different thing? If a song like Old Time Rock and Roll would have been recorded by the Silver Bullet Band instead, like how much do you think that would have changed the overall picture?
I think it would have changed it a lot. You know, with Muscle Shoals, you have a sound. Those guys are tight. And, you know, what Bob was going for was that kind of sound. He wanted this tight, kind of soulful swing to those songs he recorded with them. Whereas with, I think, what you would have gotten with Silver Bullet is something a little more raw, a little more rocking, not quite as precise, but would have had that spirit like you hear on the live records that they get. I think both are good. Possibly equally good in a commercial. I get it from the commercial standpoint. You know, when you listen to old time rock and roll, and granted it's a live recording, but would old time rock and roll with the Silver Bullet Band have been a big hit single? Not necessarily. You know, Muscle Shoals got him a sound that was very ready and friendly for the radio.
We talked about Brave Strangers a little bit earlier, and that is on Stranger in Town. And it's like listening to the Nine Tonight version of that. Something that really came out is like the keyboards on that. Like, I think that's a song that really shows why people hold the Silver Bullet Band in the same level of esteem as like the Heartbreakers and the E Street Band. Is like, you kind of, I think, hear what is special about the Silver Bullet Band listening to moments like that. For you, from your perspective, what is it that makes those guys special?
Well, that incarnation of the Silver Bullet Band, the one you hear up to Nine Tonight, you know, those were the guys who had bashed it out in the clubs and in the vans and on the road and played so much together that it was just completely instinctual. They knew how to play Bob Seger songs, and they knew how to play behind Bob Seger to show the best of Bob Seger. And you really, that was a special moment. Other versions of the Silver Bullet Band were tremendous. The one that toured behind Like a Rock was a really cool version of the band, the largest version, I think, of the Silver Bullet Band he ever had. The most recent versions of the Silver Bullet Band with my friends, the Motor City Horns, and Rob McNally on guitar, and Jim Moose Brown. From Nashville playing keyboards and guitars. I mean, you had something really special going on there. But yeah, there is nothing like that first incarnation or the golden incarnation that spent those 10,000 hours times another 100,000 hours, maybe a million hours, playing together and really turning this material into the material we came to know and love. There's no replacing that.
All right, man, here's where we're going to wrap. And that just is, talking a lot about the live show. What's kind of the show that sticks with you across the years? Like, what's the one that you still think about that just was a magic night?
Bob Seger show, I'll give you two. One was that first night seeing him in Pittsburgh. Again, just here, I'm a newbie. I'm a virgin breaking my Bob Seger cherry, and holy crap, that's good. was like being, remember the Maxell tape commercial with the guy in the chair and he gets blown
getting
back.
Blown back.
It was that didn't have as much hair as him, but that was, that it was that experience. And then when he brought the Like a Rock tour home to Detroit at Pine Knob, I think it was the first of five, maybe six shows at Pine Knob, the big amphitheater here. The vibe when they walked out on stage and then hit the first note, it felt like a coronation. It felt like an inauguration, a good inauguration. It felt, it was just everybody in that building, from the guys on stage to the people at the top of the lawn, were so happy to be there at that individual moment. And that's still, that rush still sticks with me from that. And that would have been in 83, summer of 83.
Those reunion shows, of which I saw one, like, I imagine you saw like one of the initial nights, if not the first night, like that was a moment, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was fun. It was a different Silver Bullet Band. You still had the core of Alto, Craig, and Chris, and, you had Don Brewer on the drums, which is pretty cool, from Grand Funk.
Very cool.
Fell on the Gander. But you had a bunch of other players too, so still really good, but not quite the same. And I know I sound like I'm telling you to get off my lawn. But I will go back to my sentiment that, it's hard to replace that golden era of any group, really. I mean, think about if Tom Petty had a different Heartbreakers than the ones he moved from Florida to Los Angeles to start and did all those early records on. He never did. So, you know, we never really know about that. But you could compare, you know, the Springsteen, the E Street Band to the other band, you know, that he played with in the early 80s. And that was, you know, and those were very early. And that other band he played with during the early 90s. And, you know, same kind of thing. Good, but not quite the same because of that shared history and that intuitive musicality they had together.
This has been good, man. You only told me get off your lawn one time, so I think that's pretty good for the length of time that we've been speaking. So thank you so much for taking time to do this, man. This was a lot of fun.
Always a pleasure. Now I'm going to go listen to some Bob Seger records.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.